Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Adam B. Levine. He's a blockchain expert and podcaster. This is Technotopia. This episode of Technotopia is sponsored by CheapTranscription.io. CheapTranscription offers 10 cent per minute transcriptions using our happy robots or 85 cents per minute using our human assistants. CheapTranscription.io is cheaper and faster than everyone else. CheapTranscription.io. This episode of Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter.plus. Typewriter.plus is a full-service editorial agency that brings amazing editors from places like the New York Times and TechCrunch to work on your writing. Need a blog post, a white paper, a presentation? The Typewriter team can write or edit anything on nearly any topic. Visit them at Typewriter.plus for a free quote. That's Typewriter.plus. Typewriter.plus. Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs, and I'm here with Adam Levine. He's my buddy from CoinDesk, and we used to do a bunch of podcasts together. Now we've grown separate, and I feel really bad. I feel really bad. Welcome, Adam.
Well, thanks, John. I think
it feels awful because we used to do a daily podcast, and it was a lot of fun.
Yep.
And you care about cryptocurrencies. I don't care about cryptocurrencies at all anymore, which makes me feel great.
Yep.
And I think what I would love you to do during this episode is to prove to me and the world that cryptocurrencies and crypto and blockchain is actually an important technology that will benefit us in the future.
Well, this is definitely different than what I thought we were doing today. I was like, I'm gonna have to not talk about politics. I'm gonna have to not talk about this whole laundry list of stuff. But if you just want me to yak at you about cryptocurrency,
yeah, let's do that. And like, we can bring you on. We can bring you on. So there's another podcast that we do now called Tech Hygiene that I do with Lauren Feldman. That we can do that as well. We can bring you on for that as well. That'd be a lot of fun.
I'm easy. You know me. I love the sound of my own voice.
I know
you love myself through these spectacular headphones.
you love podcasting. You love art. You love fashion.
Yes. All those things except for fashion.
Yes.
So to the topic at hand, I suppose. Cryptocurrency is different things to different people. Blockchain technology is different things to different people. So with the big hand-wavy caveat that this is my kind of personal perspective, I will go into it.
Mm-hmm.
So what blockchains really are, once you get past all of the bullshit and hype, is a better way to track ownership on the internet.
Okay.
And that kind of sounds like a really hand-wavy thing, but actually it's very specific and it's very important. And this was something that I was able to recognize coming into cryptocurrency, because before I did all this stuff and, you know, became a professional podcaster, which is hilarious that is a viable career choice in the modern era, got to tell you. But before I, you know, started earning bucks,
we're not going to get like small market DJ gigs at like 4 a.m. anymore. That doesn't exist, right? So the only way to get your voice heard is to record yourself on a GoPro.
Well, so I mean, like, just going back to that, I started doing podcasting because I really liked arguing with people and I really like winning arguments. And podcasts are a great medium for doing that, because if you run the podcast, then you can make sure you win every single argument.
I'm not going to argue with you here, so it's fine.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. Okay, so anyways, getting back into it. Before I went into the world of crypto, I used to do sales, and I worked in the cutting edge tech of environmentally friendly food service packaging. I'm not sure if you knew this about me, John.
Mm-mm.
But if you've gone to, you know, Whole Foods or whatever, and you've seen like forks there that are made of plastic that's kind of not as good as plastic used to be, that's because it's good for the environment. It's made out of a polymer created from some type of vegetable starch and oils and things like that, as opposed to petroleum, as opposed to the stuff we make gasoline out of.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the course of that, the companies that I would work with were like, you know, giant colleges, you know, like Northwestern University was one that comes to mind in Illinois. And then I worked with the Disney campus, where they kind of do all the production down in Los Angeles. And so what I would do is I would effectively work with their supply divisions to sell them all of this stuff that they would then use to stock their, you know, cafeteria or whatever. We did kind of all this environmentally friendly stuff. And another thing that we did was we worked with companies called redistributors, where we weren't selling to an end user like a college. I would sell to a dude in, you know, Arkansas or whatever. And he would, I actually remember one company called Jack's Boxes. And his whole shtick was he would buy a pallet or two of stuff from us a couple of times a month. And then he would have local clients and he would go and he would sell them that stuff. And so that's what you call a redistribution relationship, right? Where you're selling to an intermediary party and they take possession of a thing. And so when you get to the internet, that relationship doesn't exist. Instead of having resellers where somebody who actually buys inventory and then they resell it to someone else, instead we have affiliates, right? And so the difference there is that the affiliate is just kind of like a channel that connects you, you know, the person who's selling something to the person who wants to buy it. But the relationship is fundamentally between the person selling it and the person buying it. There's no intermediary. And in some situations, that's good, but in some situations, it's not. But really what it is it's an artifact of this reality where on the internet, we don't own anything. We buy licenses to stuff, but there's no way to track identity or to track ownership in any sort of provable way. Mm-hmm. And so in theory, and so in practice, there's no such thing as these reseller relationships. And it's not just that. Like you look at like, if you buy an ebook, right? Like you feel like you bought an ebook because you paid as much money for the ebook as you, you know, would have bought, you know, a real book for.
Exactly.
But you don't actually own the ebook. You own a license to consume it under very specific circumstances. But there's no such thing as like a used Kindle bookstore, right? Like you're not going to go, you know, and buy a cheaper used copy of a digital item because that doesn't exist because there's no such thing as ownership. So what blockchains introduced was this way to, without having to rely on, you know, the ownership company or, you know, something else that's going to eventually become tyrannical, you know, it was a peer-to-peer way to track ownership. And that is, in effect, what a blockchain is once you get past all of the noise. And so Bitcoin, first one to come out, kind of biggest one by market cap, any sort of metric you want to look at, Bitcoin's kind of it. That is, in effect, a blockchain that is a better way to track ownership that is specifically tracking something that wants to be money, right? So it's a better way to track ownership, and that thing that it's tracking is money. But the idea of being able to track ownership is so powerful in everything, because when you can track ownership, that means you can transfer ownership. And when you can transfer ownership, then suddenly all those problems I was talking about, all those things that exist in real life, like used bookstores, but don't exist on the internet, those can exist on the internet. And it kind of offers this fundamentally different vision of how the internet could work and how we can use the internet to interact with it in ways that are much more analogous to our real life, you know, interactions and relationships, compared to kind of this weird, amorphous, everybody is a third party, you know, reality on the internet that we have today. And I think that you know, there are advantages to that, which is that it gives us all sort of ownership over the various things that we think that we own. But with ownership, on the other hand, comes responsibility, right? Because the downside about, you know, something like Bitcoin is that, hooray, you can be your own bank, but that also means you have to be your own bank, right?
Well, you can be your own. You can be your own. It assuming this, you can also be your own used bookstore.
That's
but if your iPod breaks, then you no longer have your used books, or you no longer have your music.
Not necessarily. So it's not tied to the device, right? Blockchains are this effectively like data structure that lives in the internet. Mm-hmm. It's a database, right? It's a database that lives in the sky and everybody looks up to it. And so you plug your device into that thing in the sky and it beams it down, just like any other type of cloud service. The thing that it does introduce that I think is a danger is someone can steal your books, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like somebody can, you know, like you've got this great book collection, you know, and somebody can literally, like if they compromise, you know, like you fall for a phishing email or something like that, you know, then they can literally monetize your book collection by going to a used bookstore and dumping all of your, you know, everything that you own there at like 10 cents on the dollar. And it's terrible for you because now you don't have that any longer. And it's great for them because they just made some free money in a way that they couldn't if ownership on the internet didn't exist. So it's a with great power comes great responsibility kind of situation.
Okay. So I agree with you wholeheartedly that the idea of ownership on the internet is difficult, but if I'm on the cypherpunk aspect of the whole thing, it's that is of utmost importance. I want to be able to buy and sell a piece of software, for example.
Yeah.
And I want to know who owns it. And I want to know where it is. And I want to know that there's 20 copies of it in the world and I'm getting paid for those copies. Further, but I also want to be able to, But do I actually want to be able to do that? Because isn't it far more lucrative for me to offer a subscription to that software or offer some sort of license fee to that software versus selling a digital copy that's irreproducible and can only be owned by one person?
Aha, and here we come to the crux of the challenge that blockchains and most any disruptive technology face, which is that the people and the companies, because you're not saying that as a person, you're saying that as someone who would produce something like a subscription service.
Yeah, for
right?
example.
Like
yeah,
as Adobe, why would I want to sell somebody a license that they could then resell to mm-hmm. somebody else when I just want everybody to subscribe and pay me money every month?
Yep.
Right. So this is, in a nutshell, the problem, which is that from a consumer standpoint, this just makes a ton of sense. And from a legal mm-hmm. standpoint, this is already the way that things are. There was this case a couple of years ago. I talked to the guys actually a number of times about it, but I can't remember the company name. I think Digi Record or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, there was this case a couple of years ago where a company figured out a way that they could provably, not using blockchains or anything like that, but they could provably let you sell music that you had purchased on iTunes to someone else. And they had this whole, you know, like Harvard algorithm, whatever, where it's like at the point that you sell the thing, then it's deleted from your account and it's added to this other person's account. And then you get 40% of the money and the platform collects 60%, right? Because it's a centralized service. And so, you know, why not? But mm-hmm. hey, for you, it's great because previously that music that you bought but no longer listened to was worth $0. So kind of anything is better than the status quo. So anyways, they came up with this thing. They rolled it out. It was actually pretty popular, even with that huge take that they had. Mm-hmm. And then, bam, record companies immediately into court because they're like, no, you can't do this. That's not how this system works. We want everyone to buy this from us. And so it went through a number of, you know, it went through the kind of court system and came out kind of the end of the appeal process. And the big takeaway was that you are allowed to, under current legal doctrine, sell content that you have purchased in fully digital form. But what you're not allowed to do is violate the license. And what all of the licenses say is that you're not allowed to make unauthorized copies. And the thing about it, and the reason why this was such an interesting example of where tokens really could solve a problem, is that the way that computers work, of course, is that if you move something from one spot on your computer to another spot on your computer, you are effectively making a copy. You are deleting it. You know, it's automatically being deleted in the place where it was, and it's automatically being, you know, created in the place where, you know, in kind of the new location for it. Mm-hmm. And so what the court wound up saying was that, yes, you are legally allowed to sell your content, but that content can't be copied, which means that the only way you can actually do it is to pull the hard drive of the, you know, where you originally downloaded it to, and then sell it to someone on the hard drive so that you're not creating an illegal copy. And of course, this is completely implausible. Nobody's ever going to do this. And the record companies were like, yeah, that's how you do it. Just do that.
Yeah, the physical. Well, I mean, that hard drive is the physical representation of the music, just as a CD is a physical representation of the music.
Right.
But the nerds figured out that the CD was actually just a digital file recorded to a plastic disc, which et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So I'm enjoying this. I'm enjoying this because I think this is going to be valuable for people to understand how this works. But again, we go back to the question in, will an Amazon or will a Paramount Pictures or will Sony Music say, you know what, I think we have an idea here. We want to create the used bookstore of music because used bookstores allow for, I don't know, curation. They allow for discovery, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Versus the current systems in place. And I find that very, very hard to accept. That said, we have something like the IBM blockchains that are basically following food from field to plate, that kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, like the provenance verification use case. Yeah, I that's an okay use case. I'm not a huge fan of it because the thing of it is that when you go off of the purely digital realm, then there's a necessary weakness, right? Like you can have the best blockchain provenance tracking system in the world, but if the thing that you're tracking, you know, like a truckload of corn or whatever, right? Like all someone has to do is just take the marker off of that truckload of corn, put it onto a different truck of something else, right? Or a mm-hmm. truck of nothing, just scan the thing anyways. And, you know, you've broken the system. So there's this kind of inherent weakness between blockchains on the one hand and real life stuff on the other hand. But if we're talking about purely digital stuff, then it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So I hear your point, which is that, again, why does anyone who has the power to do this want to do this? And that's something I struggled with for a long time. And recently, not too recently, but you know, in the last couple of years, I think I've figured it out. So let's talk about gaming for a second. So like gaming on the PC, you know, has for a long time been a not monopolized affair, but a heavily dominated affair with Valve and their product Steam and their platform Steam, right, which emerged out of the Half-Life products that they created, FPSs from the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So they kind of developed this dominant relationship. And if you're like, well, hey, Steam, how about you tokenize ownership of games? Then they're going to be like, no, thank you, but no. So a couple of years ago, Epic Games came out with Fortnite. And Fortnite was such an overwhelming success for them and just an absolute money printer for them that they were like, you know what, we're going to try and do what Steam does, and we're going to subsidize, you know, we're going to try and like get a bite into their market by basically giving people free games, you know, because we're making so much money off of this other stuff. And for us, it's worth it if we can grow to become a competitor. Mm-hmm. And so in that type of an environment, then what actually happens, and we've already started to see this, there were comments somewhat recently from an executive over at Epic saying basically that ownership of games should not be tied to platforms. It should be tied to ownership of games. And it doesn't matter whether you're using Epic or it doesn't matter whether you're using Steam. Now, they're not talking about blockchains yet, but that is exactly what blockchains do in this circumstance, is they take what is typically tied to a platform and they make it so that platforms can effectively, just like on the internet, right, can read the information that's there and then interpret it into its own sort of platform, its own sort of way of things. And then you can effectively break that tie. So the incumbent never has an incentive to do it, but the runner up, right, if they have enough resources, they can make an argument where they say, this is better for users, this is better for gamers if we do this. And then
they force the incumbent's hand.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the idea would be that if I have my game and it shouldn't be a Steam game and it shouldn't be an Epic game, but it should be just a game.
That's right.
And I should be able to play it on my Xbox. I should be able to play it on the PC.
I don't necessarily know about that. Again, once you get into platform differences between that, maybe that makes the argument.
We have to redefine PC.
It's clear, I think.
Yeah. We have to redefine the idea of platform now, because I mean, at that point, I mean, what happens if you're like using a Stadia or something like that and you're playing the game over the internet? Is it yours, et cetera?
Right.
Again. Yeah. So I think the idea of coming up behind an incumbent is fascinating in this case, and it's vitally important to understand that. But I think there's also a lot of, and maybe I'm just grumpy old guy, but the idea
that's a given, but
the idea that we're in a world where the incumbent like Steam takes a hit from somebody coming up with a blockchain solution is kind of far-fetched, I think.
Well, again, not necessarily a blockchain solution in that circumstance, but, you know, the progression that we've seen in that relationship and the dynamic change and the arguments that the runner-up is starting to make, mm-hmm. they are the same argument. So whether we're talking about using this particular type of data structure or not, what we're talking about is generalizing ownership on the internet so that it's not tied to platforms, it's tied to, you know, people. And I mean, once you... And this is not, of course, restricted to just gaming. Like another market that's absolutely dominated is audiobooks, right? Like Audible, mm-hmm. owned by Amazon, is the giant, and they use their power in ways that are very giantish. You know, they mm-hmm. again, like I don't know anybody, on the production side of things, on the content creation side of things, who's happy with the way that things work at Audible. They really, I won't go into the details here, but they create, and many of these incumbent platforms where there really is no other option, create situations where the only reason that people use them is because there is no alternative.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at kind of just how creation works in general, and the real difference here is that in a world where there's only platforms like Steam or whatever, like you can only sell people content via Steam, and Steam necessarily takes a cut. You can only sell, you know, content to people who are using Apple devices via the App Store, right? Mm-hmm. You know, or certain devices anyways. And Apple always takes a cut. And I think that that's something that just winds up getting obsoleted as we move through the next 5 or 10 years and as this technology continues to develop. And it's because the reason why things have developed this way is because there wasn't an alternative, right? These platforms have become powerful because we lacked a way to track ownership and lacked a way to do these things in ways that could leverage network effect while at the same time delivering the value, you know, that I think needs to be there. But if you look at like how content creation works today, there's really no reason why a musician isn't selling a digital CD to someone, and then that digital CD can be used on Spotify or on YouTube or kind of any of these other places. Instead, mm-hmm. we have like a million systems, none of which work particularly well, and all of which then create their own sort of lock-in effect.
Yeah, so, you lock your thing in.
Yeah, exactly. So again, like if you're an incumbent, then that's a good plan. But if you're not an incumbent, then it actually creates an opportunity for you to use systems like this and to use new technology to offer a better experience to users that does go beyond what the platforms can do without needing to achieve a network effect by yourself. Now, network effects are things in a paradigm like this that can be achieved by many companies that just share a common ownership layer, basically. And where, again, like there's no necessarily lock-in to that particular platform, which is both good and bad. But I mean, how many relationships do we have in real life where it's like, oh, the only reason why I, you know, listen to music, you know, on my CD player is because it's the only CD player that I'm allowed to listen to music on. Like it's a ridiculous standard that doesn't exist mm-hmm. anywhere except for the internet. And again, it's because there was no better option before something like blockchain. But that's
when does all this change? When do we flip the script? When do we say that, okay, I now have a general purpose computer that can play content that I own versus I have a machine that can only run iTunes and right. and I play the music that's available there.
Again, hard questions. All this stuff is difficult to predict. But if you look at, I think that Bitcoin is instructive here, right? Because Bitcoin, launched in 2009, so it's been around for just a little bit over 10 years. And we have in the last 2 years specifically seen really big moves with this whole idea of blockchainized or truly digital money that uses a real, you know, you're not using a bank in the background to transfer mm-hmm. this around, right? You're actually using a peer-to-peer network to do that. So if you look at kind of the history of Bitcoin, it was not taken particularly seriously at all for the first 5 or 6 years. And then as time went on, people were like, oh, it's a speculative asset. And now more recently, a couple of years ago, we saw, I guess just a year and a half ago, we saw Facebook and Zuck's Project Libra, right? Which is like money on the internet with a better ownership layer, except by Facebook and a consortium mm-hmm. of other, you know, corporate giants and some sort of oligarchy situation.
And it's doing surprisingly well, by the way. It's really taking off.
Well, I mean, it hasn't done anything yet. But the whole point is that it then forced a conversation at the nation state level, where now you've got, you know, the Federal Reserve talking seriously about a central bank digital currency, as they call them, which is basically blockchain money, but government's doing mm-hmm. it, and it's not decentralized in the same way that you would want it to be. And China is like, hey, we're not only doing this, we're creating our own entire ecosystem of this technology that's going to do everything and all sorts of different ownership on the mm-hmm. internet, the Chinese way. And you've got, you know, countries around the world, both big and small, who are doing this. So I think that it's something like that. I think that, again, the hardest step is the first one, right? The hardest step is the guy who's going to go out there and be like, you know what? Actually, we're the Facebook, but for music, right? As far as sort of these new ownership systems are concerned. And then I think once that starts, you know, again, we're seeing it with like PayPal and whatever. Supposedly they're integrating crypto stuff, crypto buy and sell into their products. And it's not because they want to. It's not because they ideologically like any of the stuff that's going on there. It's because it's become almost a missed opportunity to not do it because they mm-hmm. see competitors doing it and making just a ton of revenue by comparison. So it's that. It's like it's not something that anybody wants to do. But once somebody serious does it, then it becomes effectively a race. And the sooner you do it, the better you place, and the longer you wait, the more you miss out. And I think that that's going to be true across all of these different use cases as well. They're just like 5 years earlier than Bitcoin is.
All right. I'll believe it when I see it. Ultimately, I think
me too.
The answer. Yeah. I mean, that's, That's the most frustrating thing about the technology. Cause I mean, I, your description is probably one of the best that I've heard ever. And it's very, very, and it's very, very succinct, and it's very, very, but it's also flies against every single aspect and every single, way we, method that we understand ownership on the internet, because thus far the easiest thing to do has been to license and has been to, do copy protection and has been to create obfuscate of like whatever security through obfuscation or security through obscurity, in terms of software, in terms of, systems, in terms of games, all that other good stuff. And primarily because we didn't have a blockchain, right? We didn't have a blockchain before. I would love to see it. I would love to see it happen. I would love there to be a way that I can drag my music from device to device. Right. Assuming that I had more than one type of device, that's the other question. I mean, I don't really have, it's not like I'm going from iOS to Android to Linux.
Well, I mean, or just a different really service happens. Again, like just the choice, you know, like that's the whole point is that it kind of gives back choice to the end user who in theory owns the thing, but in practice doesn't, you know, it flies in the face of ownership on the internet and the way that everything works there. But again, if you compare it to really any other way that we engage with things or people in real life, it's completely analogous. So it's a lot like saying it can, you know, it's not going to happen because it's not going to happen. I don't know.
No. It's not going to happen because it's not going to happen. That's the trick. So right. Like, so it's like, so yeah, we've, and I think a lot of the early thinkers, in online, like the whatchamacallit, the
this is the way they all these manifestos they couldn't figure it out.
Well, they also wanted general for like example like the new foundation, all that stuff, the open source consortiums. Yeah. Those are all based on no one owns digital product because it's infinitely reproducible. So there's no reason for me to own a piece of code because I can just send it to you and you got it and now it's part of your DNA. So that to tease all that stuff out is almost impossible. And for example, you're in a situation where like the big banks will try to sue people and put them in jail for using open source code in projects that they're doing outside of the banks because they initially used those projects, that code inside the bank and then quit and started their own companies. And that warrants enough of an issue to basically call people out on it. And that's ridiculous as well.
We can all agree that banks are excellent people and good at their job.
Yeah, exactly. And for us to assume that banks are going to follow your lead and say, hey, here's the ownership system in place so you know what you own and we know what we own and we're going to ensure that you own this forever and ever and you can just be your own bank, et cetera, is pretty naive. I don't think it's going to happen ever. And anybody who says so, is just cruising for a bruising. But I think in terms of the smaller players coming up behind the incumbents, it could happen, but it's really, really hard, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely hard. There's no question about that. I mean, the other thing that I think about with this stuff is that we are at something of an inflection point right now, I think, in sort of modern history. And the way that things have been in many ways is unsustainable. And so I think that there's kind of like, that's true when you look at like the big picture of things, like how does the world work? But it's also true when you look at the little picture of things, like how does YouTube work, right? Like the way that YouTube does, so it's not just annoying, this whole lack of ownership thing. It's actually problematic from a lot of different perspectives. And so if you look at like when you upload a piece of content to YouTube, YouTube does not know who owns that content. YouTube does not know the licensing terms that they are allowed to, you know, to mess with it under. They don't know if they can sell ads against it, except for what the person who uploaded it has told them, right? And that person can lie, and there's nothing really to stop that from happening. Mm-hmm. So again, like the way that we do, so as a rights holder, the way that you solve that problem is you literally look at the entire internet everywhere constantly for anyone who's using something that you have the rights to, you know, and that you have not granted them the rights to. And then you as the creator or the creator's agent have to proactively contact YouTube, and then YouTube does a thing. And this is true of literally everywhere on the internet. And this is before deep fakes and before, mm-hmm. you know, all of the other nonsense that's going to come out of kind of the AI revolution, in kind of the near future. And again, you just contrast that to the way it would work in a blockchain situation where all of the data, all of the information about who owns it, all of the information about how you can monetize it, who needs to be paid, under what circumstances it can be used, all of that stuff, instead of being nowhere except for a legal document that you own, mm-hmm. In the trademark office, instead lives on a blockchain. And when a piece of content gets uploaded, then it gets referenced against that, you know, its fingerprint gets taken, it gets compared against that. And then suddenly YouTube can know. And it doesn't matter who uploaded. It doesn't matter if the legal rights holder uploaded it anymore. YouTube is now covered. And the person who uploaded it, they can even make money off of it, right? The licensing terms of that uploaded piece of content could say, if you're uploading something somewhere and you're the person who's uploading it and you drive people to consume it or you have a big following, then you get 2% of the, mm-hmm. of the money that's generated by it or something like that.
And that's okay, I got it.
Yeah, you got it. Okay.
So, no, I think the answer is this. So when we're all living in VR, when we're all we become languid and like we're like big and fat and awful, and we just like sit in VR all day, I want to be able to pull my little CD out of my little virtual bag, Prada bag, by the way,
virtual
that I own, and I want to be able to put in my little virtual Sony CD player that I own, and that's the case when it's all going to happen, because that's when we want ownership, because we're still interacting with each other in this virtual world.
And
we want to recreate that. We want to recreate the techniques that we used to love and know and love. So I'll buy that once we're all in virtual land and like floating in vats and stuff. That's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're wrong about that. I think that again, but we're so far away from that in the current spat of technology. I do think that there will be movement on this sooner than that. I think that we will see many of the large influencers who have these kind of massive audiences on the big platforms, like they don't need the platforms anymore. Mm-hmm. And this allows them to, again, like to build a network effect, but to own the thing that they're building, right? And to own the relationships with their audience in a way that they just don't now. And so again, like if all the platforms were like, we're platforms and we don't make any judgment calls and you can do whatever you want so long as it's not literally illegal, then I think mm-hmm. there would be no opportunity here. But in practice, we're not seeing that. We're seeing increasing amounts of sort of power exercised in seemingly arbitrary fashions. You know, like you might agree with the reasons why it's being done today, but you might disagree with them tomorrow. And certainly a lot of people do disagree with sort of the increasing techniques that are being used today. So I think, again, there's that. It's really what we're waiting for, in my opinion, is the revolt of the influencers where they take it indie, right? But they take it indie in a way that allows them to build that network effect together while still fundamentally owning their business. That's really what I've come to over the last couple of years, is that the way that blockchain gets adopted is because it's a good business move for people who actually have the audiences already and can make those changes. And then, of course, the other thing is that the technology for so long has really just been developed with enthusiasts in mind, which is something that I figured out in 2015 was just the dumbest possible thing to do, because nobody is like, I'm wildly enthusiastic about this technology, and it's terrifying to use it sometimes. Like just terrifying.
The enthusiast market is no winner. You can never win with enthusiasts, because the enthusiasts are never happy.
Well, I don't know. Like the enthusiasts in cryptocurrency are happy when they're making money, right?
Yeah.
Then they're very, very enthusiastic about it. But again, it's like, you know, all of the projects that have come out, not all of the projects, I'm not going to make that generalization, but of the projects that I've looked at, I'd say at least 99% of them, and possibly, you know, 99.9% of them are intended for that enthusiast market. And you just can't grow with that. There's no possibility for success when that's kind of the strategy. But I think that that's something that's finally being recognized by sort of a number of other projects. And we'll see. I have high hopes.
I think personally that you should probably do a podcast just of your own, just focusing on blockchain. Have you ever considered doing that?
Yeah. So if you'd like to hear me talk about more of this, I'll take the plug. I do a show called Let's Talk Bitcoin. It's at ltbshow.com. And I've been doing it since 2013, along with some of the other biggest names in cryptocurrency.
All right. So I think this is actually going to be immensely valuable, because I mean, for you to explain it is like having like freaking Einstein sit down and explain E=mc². So that's pretty cool. Yeah, it was good stuff. So thank you for joining us, Adam. This has been amazing.
Absolutely. But I just want to say for the record, I can't be responsible for your happiness.
And I don't expect you to, ultimately. I don't expect you to at all. This has been Technotopia. I'm John Biggs. We will see you next week. Damn, boy.
Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.